ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, Tegan Taylor here from Life Matters. Do you rely on grandparents to help pay the bills or look after the kids? You're not alone. Life has gotten busier, more expensive, and grandparents are picking up the slack. This July on Radio National, The Grandparent Trap explores the changing role of grandparents in modern family life. The Grandparent Trap and much more on Life Matters. Search for Life Matters on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, it's the music show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. That's music by William Basinski. It's from his Disintegration Loops. And William's on his way to Australia to host a sleepover. He's presenting all four albums of the Disintegration Loops for the Now or Never Festival, and he'll join me later in this hour. We're also going to revisit a conversation from 2002 with the Irish singer-songwriter Glenn Hansard, who you may have heard died this week. And we have another William for you. Will Swenson is in Australia to play Neil Diamond in the musical A Beautiful Noise, very appropriate for a hot August night. Because it's August, that means that Middle of the Air is back for 2026. And throughout this month, we are receiving your entries of poems to be turned into songs. And I'm very excited to let you know who this year's two artists are.
There's a crater in the middle of my chest. I've had to rearrange each organ, and I confess it's been a little hard having people notice everything I feel deep inside me when I'm just trying to pretend. I know.
With everything, I try to make sure that I am feeling the words in my body when I say them out loud. There's a kind of a very physical feeling that I get if something's working. It's like a kind of humming in my body, and it's conjuring up things, you know, it's conjuring up feelings and memories in a very visceral way.
Music gives poetry a body. It lets word move through breath, tone, timing, and repetition. Poetry gives music precision. It sharpens feeling into something that can be held, questioned, and returned to.
I've read what was written, your histories and scriptures. What we've been living is something much different. Don't
Missy Higgins and Ziggy Ramo, both of them familiar voices to music show listeners, they are your middle of the air artists for 2026. And entries are open now via the Radio National website in partnership with Red Room Poetry. And you'll be able to hear the finished versions of the winning entries in November here on The Music Show for Oz Music Month. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. Will Swenson is a big name on Broadway. Sometimes Broadway performers step into roles created by others. Will's been in revival casts of Les Miserables and Hair and Assassins. But he's also taken on a new role in A Beautiful Noise, and this is a revival of a different sort. Will originated the role of Neil Diamond in the show, and it takes Neil Diamond's songs and it tells Neil Diamond's story with them. Let's start with The Real Thing. Here's Neil.
We'll be right back. song been on my mind. And the tune can be sung and the words all rhyme. Diddle-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-doo. And it don't say much and it won't offend if you sing it in school, then I will send you home. Never knowing what you're growing.
Crunchy Granola Sweet from the famous live album Hot August Night. And that was the real Neil Diamond. And I'm very pleased to say that now in the Music Show studio, we've got, I won't say the fake Neil
Diamond. The fake Neil Diamond. Happy to stand in those shoes, please.
The man who has been playing Neil Diamond for some time now in a beautiful noise, Will Swenson, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
You're a lifelong Neil Diamond fan, aren't you? I mean, lifelong.
Yes. My dad's favorite singer of all time was Neil Diamond. I grew up with him in my house just on a loop. We literally had a poster of Neil Diamond on our wall in our garage, and he just kind of was in my bones from as long back as I can remember.
So you must have been waiting for this musical to come along.
For real. I legitimately, before this was ever a musical, I had said to friends, I'm just waiting for the Neil Diamond musical because that one's mine. And then it happened.
Now, this is an authorized musical. I mean, it was Neil Diamond's idea. He greenlit it. So it's not, you know, there was no need to kind of concoct a story involving characters called Caroline and Cherry and, you know, in order to make the songs fit.
No. Yes, Neil was definitely on board. I think over the years, he'd been approached about it many times. And often it was just kind of a concert-y concept. And he wanted to do something a little more deep emotionally. And I think finally the right writer pitched him the right idea. And he said, yeah, that's the one I want to do. And here we are.
Yeah. So tell me about actually getting into the show. I mean, you said that this was your ambition, but presumably since this was a Neil Diamond notion, he had to be convinced that you were a passable imitation of him.
Yes, you're asking me about probably the most nervous I've ever been in my entire life. So the producer for this show had approached me and he said, "Hey, I hear you do a pretty good Neil Diamond." And I said, "Yes, I'm your guy. Is there a musical?" And he said, yeah, we're getting a group together. We're going to do a small reading. And once we kind of get it together, we're gonna pitch it to Neil Diamond. We're going to all sit in a room and you're going to sing 20 Neil Diamond songs in front of Neil to get the green light or no. So no pressure, right? And so Neil showed up one day and was very kind and lovely. And I think I blacked out from my nerves. But we proceeded to read this musical in front of him and sing all of the songs. And I was doing my best Neil Diamond impression right 10 feet away from Neil. And he liked it. He went for it. So I ended up being the guy.
Because there's a sort of difference, isn't there, between inhabiting the personality of the character that you're performing and sort of taking it too far, you know, kind of 100%. Almost turning it into a caricature. So where Yes. do you find that sweet spot?
Yeah, you know, that was a discussion we had a lot in rehearsals. I mean, everyone knows what Neil Diamond sounds like, and there's definitely the need to honor that and embody him. But if you get into kind of impression in Rich Little Land, then the evening kind of becomes about this sound that someone's making and not necessarily the story that we're telling. So we've, I think, found a pretty good middle ground where I emulate his energy and his sound a bit, but it's not distracting.
No, but in a way, his sound is in the songs, isn't it? Because he has quite a distinctive voice and quite a distinctive range. You know, there's a kind of, it's a real baritone.
For real, yeah. And that's something that for me personally, I feel like it has kind of gone away to an extent. The world has kind of just gone into the higher you can sing, the better. And Neil was having none of that. He's very much a low baritone and lived in that range. And there's just such a width to his sound and his voice. And then there's that gravel in it that's so distinctive.
And that's a very important part of the songs, isn't it? I mean, the songs are actually composed to display that voice.
100%. Yeah, he definitely wrote for himself. A lot of people don't know that Neil was a songwriter long before he became a performer. He was selling songs and, you know, he wrote "I'm a Believer" and sold that to the Monkees. And that was his kind of first big hit as a songwriter. And that he wrote a lot of songs that people don't associate with him. "Red, Red Wine" is one that he wrote. And, you know, that was a big hit for UB40 in the 80s. But a lot of folks don't know that's a Neil Diamond song to start.
No, and I'm a believer that that's 1966 that the Monkees did it. So that's quite a career.
Yeah. I think he's been writing for six decades now, if not in his seventh decade of writing. And he just put out a new album last month. I think it's his 42nd album or something crazy like that.
That is crazy. Maybe even unnecessary at this point.
Yeah, you can't help it.
I had never heard Neil Diamond's recording of "I'm a Believer" until yesterday. And I was surprised to discover how much like the Monkees it is. It's like, it's almost like he did a kind of a demo for them. But then I read that he's actually on the Monkees recording.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Right.
That's interesting. I do know that that he sold it to the Monkees and they did their version. And then years later, he sort of took it back and stripped it down and he would do a kind of a mellow guitar version of it in concert. But then he ramps it up and kind of to honor the Monkees, he peps it up again.
Yes. Well, they couldn't really play their instruments, I think, at that point in their careers, at least. So they needed other people to come and help out.
So you played for them. That's great.
LA is fine. The sun shines most of the time. And the feeling is laid back. Palm trees grow and rents are low, but you know, keep thinking about making my way back. Well, I'm New York City born and raised, but nowadays I'm lost between two shores. LA is fine, but it ain't home. New York's home, but it ain't mine no more.
I cried.
That's a little of I Am, I Said. That's the voice of Neil Diamond. And I'm talking on today's music show to Will Swenson, and we're talking about this show, A Beautiful Noise, which is the Neil Diamond musical. Maybe we could talk a little about the songs, because immersing myself in them, obviously not as much as you have been, but in the last few days listening to them, I realize there are Neil Diamond fingerprints in these songs, and I haven't sort of sat down to try and analyze what that is, but there's something very distinctive about not the sound of the voice, but the actual melodies and the chords.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about this? Do you know what it is?
I don't. I wish I could put my finger on it, but there's something in the DNA of his songs that is universally appealing. You know, I don't think it's a fluke that Sweet Caroline has become an anthem worldwide that people just can't help but sing along to. There's something in Neil's music. I think it's a couple of things, honestly. He knows how to write a hook, just kind of an earworm that just goes in and stays in. You know, we find ourselves at rehearsals just like we come in the next day and we say, "Are you waking up to you know, Sweet Caroline in your head as well?" Everyone can't get the songs out of their head, and we're not mad about it. But the other thing is, I think he genuinely always wrote from an emotionally honest place. I don't think Neil was always just trying to sell a song. I think he couldn't write unless it was true, and that helps our story a lot in the show. We're always kind of on a narrative track. He's always going through something and writing about it. So his songs are really emotionally honest. They're not just bubblegum poppy songs. I think they're always connected to something, and I think just something in us when we hear them reaches and grabs that and understands that this is coming from an emotionally honest place.
Yeah. Tell us about the show, because I haven't seen it, but I noticed that there are two Neil Diamonds.
That's right, yeah. Neil himself wanted to, you know, he always said, "I want to tell my story warts and all." He wanted to tell the tricky parts as well as the successes, and not have it just be kind of a jukebox concerty evening. You know, we knew the songs would be great. We knew the audiences would come for the music, and they do, and they love it. But he wanted to have an engaging, emotional story as well. So our book writer, Anthony McCartan, is actually a screenwriter, and he hadn't written for the theater before. But he had this idea about framing the show in an interesting way. So the idea is, the show opens with Neil, modern-day Neil, 83 years old, I think he is now, in therapy. And he's looking back on his life and coming to terms with the fact that he can't perform anymore. Neil's been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. So after, you know, 6 decades of touring and being a superstar, he no longer can tour. And so the show is the modern day Neil looking back on his life with a certain amount of, you know, regret and contemplation, and I get to be the younger guy kind of going through the steps of struggling and you know, failed marriages and failed record deals and signing a bad record deal and all those troubles. And so it's a nice format for complexity and something to fight for and fight against as an actor. It's not just singing cute songs, but something to really, really fight for. And with the two Neils on stage, it's actually a really cool theatrical device as well, because he kind of gets in my space, and, you know, maybe he wants to keep me from signing the bad record deal, and the modern day Neil is like kind of trying to pull the pen out of my hand. And there's a lot of kind of neat meta energy going on between the two actors. So I find it really engaging as an actor.
That's nice. And you also, I imagine, are able to sing songs just because they are the next song in his career, rather than because they apply to a particular dramatic moment. Or, well, do you do that too?
I think we were pretty lucky in that Neil has so many hits that we were able to sort of smartly drop the songs into the slots of his life where certain things were happening. And I'd say just about all of them have a little bit of dramatic edge to them and storytelling to them. They're not just in situ songs. There is one section that we call the stadium medley, where he's, you know, on top of the world and he's playing a million different stadiums all over the world. And those songs, you know, were just kind of rocking and rolling. And in fact, Crunchy Granola Sweet that we just listened to is one of them, which is an incredibly fun thing to do. But most of them, honestly, kind of fit nicely within the storyline of Neil's life and kind of further the plot, so to speak.
Well, you're going to do one for us to finish. You're going to do Kentucky Woman. Where does this fit in the show?
He's in the studio with Ellie Greenwich from the old Tin Pan Alley days.
We had her on the music show once.
Did you really?
Yeah.
How terrific. Oh, that's neat. That's neat. She's invited him into the studio to do some demos, and Kentucky Woman is the demo that he picks. And this is the moment where Ellie says, you know what, you're not just a songwriter. You've got an amazing voice and you need to sing your own songs. And she tries to convince him of that in this moment.
So no pressure on you then, Will.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for coming on The Music Show.
My absolute pleasure. Nice to chat with you.
Kentucky woman, she shine with her own kind of light. She look at you once in a day, that's all wrong, looks all right. And I love her, God knows I love her. Kentucky woman, if she get to know you, she going to own you. Kentucky woman, well, she ain't the kind make heads turn at the drop of her name. But something inside that she's got turns you on just the same. And she loves me, God knows she loves me. Kentucky woman, if she get to know you, she going to own you. Kentucky woman, don't want much. The good Lord's earth beneath my feet, a gentle touch from that one girl, and life is sweet and good. There ain't no doubt I'm talking about. Kentucky woman, if she get to know you, she going to own you. Kentucky woman, Kentucky woman, Kentucky woman.
Will Swenson performing Kentucky Woman, originally by Neil Diamond, and you can catch Will in A Beautiful Noise from the 5th of August in Melbourne and the 14th of November in Sydney. The details on the music show's website. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Glenn Hansard, the Irish singer-songwriter, died this week in a motorcycle accident. He was 56. He was probably best known for his performance in the film Once in 2007. He didn't just act in it. He was one of the co-stars, or sing in it. He also composed many of the songs, and he won an Oscar for Falling Slowly. But he was also one of the great voices in Irish folk rock. And when Shane McGowan died, it was Glenn Hansard and Lisa O'Neill who performed the great Shane McGowan song, Fairy Tale of New York, at Shane's funeral. He started early. He formed his band The Frames when he was just a teenager, and we had The Frames on the show in 2002, and I talked to Glenn with a couple of the other members of the band, and I think we should listen to some of that conversation now. I started by asking Glenn about the sound of the 2001 album For the Birds and how much they'd planned before they entered the studio.
Well, we had talked a lot. We had sort of spent a few weeks down in a house in Kerry, which probably gives it some sort of probably has some sort of influence on how relaxed it sounds, because we were cooking for each other every night and going for walks on the beach and discussing for the first time in our career what we wanted from a record. You know, because up to that point it was always let's record this song, let's record that song, see, and usually the record would come together as a collection as opposed to a fixed,
a work.
Yeah, exactly, a fixed idea of a record. So the philosophy behind it originally was, let's play as slow and as sort of sad and as simple as we can. Let's try to break all, let's try get rid of all of the unnecessary points, I'll try to play as less rhythm guitar, as little rhythm guitar as I can, and let everything else hold the melodies and let the rhythm fall away from the middle. So stuff like, we talked a lot about music, and so I suppose that might have some sort of influence on the actual sound of it. With regard to microphoning and stuff like that, it was all pretty cheap microphones thrown over thrown over instruments.
Well, we've got these, the ABC's microphones are cheap as well, which is probably why this sounds like the album.
Yeah, probably.
Well, the songwriting, which you are more responsible for than most, yeah, is that something that takes the sound into account at the beginning? When you have an idea for a song, a tune, some words, do you also know that there is going to be a sort of a dull bass drum or a bit of banjo involved?
My sort of musical intelligence would go as far as maybe a bit of banjo. In terms of dull bass drum and stuff like that, I'm pretty illiterate. I would, I'd have some sort of idea that I wanted it to sound like a certain mood, or, so sometimes we'd sit down and we'd say, play it like you've just been beaten up, or, but I wouldn't have any, like, Joe would be much better at sort of discussing, how to mic something or how to make it sound sadder or something. For me, it's always just been a case of make me sound like Brad Pitt or make me sound like Brad Pitt looks, as opposed to knowing how to do that,
I should tell our listeners that in fact Glenn does look a lot like Brad Pitt. I was rather staggered when I walked into the studio and saw him. Actually, I thought I'd come into the wrong room.
Overwhelmed.
When, again, to say that we've got an Irish band on the show today, and there's a fiddle player, I mean, people would normally think, oh right, yes, I know exactly what to expect. Mm-hmm. I've heard one of those Irish bands with a fiddle before. It's not though that your music is utterly separated from folk, is it? There is something there,
I suppose.
Calm.
It's that. Yeah, I mean, we started off as buskers, and so our background, my background would be kind of traditional as well as classical. So, and I think kind of that at this stage we're influencing in the record and stuff, that it's I think at this point we're far more kind of confidence, yeah, to not worry about sounding kind of, it kind of sounds as it sounds, and the kind of the analysis happens afterwards.
Yes.
So definitely in the past, kind of, it's a thing that kind of every Irish band traveling the world playing music will have, because we come from a strong tradition that it's that's gone before us, that everybody will want to, to somehow, or would imagine what they're about to hear. Yeah. So it's not terrible.
I think when we started off, we were much more paranoid about the idea of a violin being in the band in terms of what it would do to the public idea of who we are. Because at the time, the Waterboys were like the reigning champs. Mm. In the folk sort of rock world, and we were very influenced by them, of course. And so there was a kind of a paranoia within us, like, we're a punk rock band and the violin just happens to be there as part of, some sort of interesting angle we're coming from, whereas in actual fact it made a lot of sense, and when we're being really honest, it's the sort of Van Morrison Into the Music or Bob Dylan's, Desire record.
Desire, yeah.
That we're all really sort
totally,
of
yeah.
But where the violin really fits into the frames, as opposed to it being a sort of a trad instrument that we can, that we can sort of throw a bit of Irish music over rock. It's we've always really cringed at that idea.
Yes. And the I mean, by the same token, the banjo and mandolin don't exactly make you a bluegrass band.
Exactly. Yeah. Just pulling in influences. So what happens when the heart just stops caring for anyone? The hollow in your chest dries up and you stop believing. So what happens when the heart gives up, but the body goes on living? The blood crawls to a slow and stop, and it goes away. Well, we've got no one to meet, no love we would beseech. We only have ourselves to blame for everything. Well, there was no answer in the dust, and I'm missing you so much. But now you're sleeping and I'm leaving, empty-handed waiting. Time it will subside and we'll agree. It was a given, yeah. There was no standard we could set, and the world, it does regret to have to leave you in a state of bereavement. You see, I'm feeling everything. Nothing gets by. Well, there is a hollow in my chest, and this time I won't forget. There is no comfort in the eyes that put us always to the test. I can't prepare myself for that, but I'll work it out in time. There is a love that flows between us, ever changing every day. I worked myself up to a crawl. Well, I'm not fearing it at all. We had no reason left to stay, and that's why we're leaving, yeah. Well, there was no answer in the dust, and no one out there to trust. There is this light that drags us beating and pulling into disappointment and disappointment and disappointment. And so we wait until you're gone.
The Frames performing What Happens When the Heart Just Stops. And before that, you heard from Glenn Hansard from 2002. Glenn Hansard died this week at the age of 56. It's The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. William Basinski's Disintegration Loops is a good example of American ambient music. It goes for more than 5 hours across 4 albums, and it's not often presented in one sitting. The Now or Never Festival has invited William to do just that. It's a sleepover event called Somnia, and if you go to it, you can decide whether you want to sleep or sit up and listen to the full 5 hours. William Basinski joins me in a moment, and we will start our conversation near the end of the Disintegration Loops. William Basinski, welcome back to The Music Show.
Thank you, Andy. Great to be back with you over there, down under.
Last time you were on, which was in 2018, we talked at length about the disintegration loops. But obviously there will be people listening to this conversation who weren't listening to that one, or who have possibly forgotten one or two of the details. So could I ask for a quick summary of what is happening here?
Well, what happened was, in late July 2001, I had gotten a new piece of technology, CD burner. And in the back storage room, we called the land that time forgot, I came across all of these big cases full of old tape loops and stuff that I had been working on in the very early 80s. And I knew from having more recent friends that were studio engineers about what happens to old analog tape, i.e. dropout. In those early days, in the late 70s and the early 80s, I was using found reels of tape and old reel-to-reel tape decks from a junk store to create my loops. Analog tape is a piece of plastic that'll last forever with iron oxide particles, rust, basically glued on, you know, so the first thing that loses its integrity is the glue. In the studio in 2001, I start to pick up where I left off, digitizing this group of loops that I was working on. And the first one I put on, I was like, oh, this is amazing. I didn't really remember any of these because at the time in the early 80s, I was 22, 23, 24, 25. You know, I was making these loops, grabbing little bits of string sounds and things off of the American Popular Standards radio station that was the strongest signal in New York coming from the top of the Empire State Building. And I loved string sounds. I wanted a Mellotron, but I couldn't afford one, so I was going to try to make my own. I knew they were made with tape loops. So basically, I would grab little bits of string interludes, and then I would slow them down. And out of this anesthesia music, you slow it down, and all of a sudden, there's this deep well of melancholy. But at that time, I wanted to really be involved. So I was mixing live with shortwave radio, static. And sometimes when I would discover these loops, they were so amazing and so perfect and looped so perfectly. I, at that age, really wasn't sure if I could, you know, call that my work. I didn't know what to do with it. So I put those aside. Well, anyway, here you go 20 years later, and this group of six loops were some of the ones that I set aside and had forgotten about. And the first one that came up ended up becoming Disintegration Loop 1.1, this very grave, stately melody. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I just loved what was going on with it. And so I dialed in a counter melody to create a new composition on my Voyetra 8 analog synthesizer using a sort of a randomly arpeggiating French horn kind of sound, and it was playing against it so beautifully. So I started recording, and I was just like, wow, this is cool. I wonder what's going to happen. So let it go for a while, went to the kitchen to make a cup of coffee, and came back in and started noticing, wait, something's happening. Looking into the tape deck, I can see there's dust starting to fall on the tape path, and I could tell the music was changing. And I thought, oh my God, let me check my levels. Here we go. And over the period of one CDR, about an hour or so, the loop itself disintegrated. And what was amazing about it was that sort of the core of the melody somehow managed to hold on, like the attacks and things like that. But the decays of the notes seemed to fade away from the end, leaving silence and noise and stuff like that. And then I went and pulled up the second one and go get a cup of coffee, come back. And then it started to cascade much faster than I was prepared. And I thought, oh no, listen, girl, you don't need any counter melodies in here. This is something else. It's not about you. Pay attention. Make sure your levels are good. And just document this, because this is one time only. So over the period of the next 2-day session with all the 6 loops, that's what I did. And then I knew, oh my God, what just happened? Called all my friends, told them, get over here. You won't believe what's happening. Anoni and my friend Howard Schwartzberg. I always have to talk about Howard because he's so fabulous. He's a wonderful artist I've known for years in New York. He makes all these deconstructed paintings. Went to art school, knew everything about French deconstructionism and all that kind of stuff that I had no idea about. He came over, we got stoned, and we sat there and listened to the whole thing. And he's got this great Coney Island accent. And he's like, Billy, this is it. You've done it. And he was right, because when we finally started releasing it, all the critics went wild. And it saved my loft, got me out of $30,000 of debt, and started my career. So that's the basic story.
It's a great story, and I love it. I think one of the golden rules of composing is to know when to stand back. But yes. This is on a grand scale, isn't it? I mean,
yes, but you have to be mature enough to understand that. And in the early days, I may have panicked or something, you know?
Yes, I can see that. Whereas actually the solution in this case was to go back in the kitchen, make another cup of coffee.
Or get a beer.
yeah, that's right. When you perform disintegration loops live, what happens?
Well, normally I don't present the original works live unless I'm doing something like what's going to happen in Melbourne, where it's, and I've done these a few times before, where there's like an all-night sleepover kind of thing for stoners. And it's basically what people call a diffusion. I'm pressing play, and we get to listen to the music in its new master on a fantastic sound system in an extraordinary space with everyone all together who's there to be there for this rare occurrence. So I don't do that very often, but I have occasionally. What we've been doing since Maxime Mostyn first transcribed Disintegration Loop 1.1 and 2, and we have all of them transcribed, is having orchestras, chamber orchestras and orchestras play the pieces all over the world. But that's something that's very expensive and requires years of programming to try to make happen. So that is a rare occurrence.
And also, I have to ask, I don't mean to be rude, but what's the point?
The point of what?
Of having this music, which you've just described how it came about, transcribed and played by a chamber orchestra.
It's incredible. You've never heard it?
What do you get from it, though? How do you get...
I get to sit in the audience and watch all these musicians that I adore who have dedicated their lives to creating beauty for other people. These scores sound very simple, but they are not, particularly because you're repeating the same little movements over and over again, and then you have to count constantly because it changes over the period of 40 minutes or whatever. I mean, it just breaks my heart. It's an incredible experience. It just takes it to another level and puts it back into pencil and paper and, you know, rosin on catgut and lips on trombone mouthpieces and oboe mouthpieces and you know, this kind of thing. So it's something.
Well, you say it takes it back to pencil and paper, but it was never in pencil and paper were never involved. And so I wonder what the relationship is between what you hear from a chamber orchestra and what you originally made. You say it takes it to another level, but what's the relationship?
Well, it's beautiful, and it you have to experience it. It's quite a profound thing for me to have my work transcribed by a brilliant, you know, trained musician who actually finished music school and studied orchestration and all the things that I didn't do, and have the work presented in a formal way like that. It's extraordinary.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm talking to William Basinski about his Disintegration Loops. Let's widen the conversation if we can, because the last time you were on, we talked exclusively about this music and how it came about. What we never talked about was your antecedents as a composer, and I wonder who they are. I mean, for example, you know, earlier this year, we paid tribute to Elian Radig, who died at the age of 94, and she was an important influence on a lot of composers who work with tape. And obviously, Brian Eno is behind some of what you do, not least in Music for Abandoned Airports. I mean, the clue's in the title.
Look, at the time I was coming up, you know, there was no internet or anything like that. And although my partner, James Elaine, was an incredible music lover and record collector, worked at record stores when I first met him, and just always had to have the coolest stuff. He worked on the buying truck at this big record store in Berkeley, and he would get the coolest stuff from Germany and stuff. This is in the late 70s and stuff, and bring it home. And I got to hear all this stuff right out of school when I moved there to San Francisco. And he was a huge mentor. And so I was hearing, you know, Can and Connie Plank and Tangerine Dream and Frippin' Eno and Dockstader and all these other people. And so hearing synthesizer music and hearing drone music and all this kind of stuff, and it just blew everything open for me. I really did not become familiar with Elian Radig back then, because she just wasn't, you know, it's not like recently where she's become much more renowned, deservedly, than she was back then. And so, you know, Pauline Oliveras, John Cage, because of what I learned in the one amazing new music class I had in North Texas State University when I was there, learning about Cage and how you didn't have to write pencil on paper and anything could be music, and even silence was music, and radios and this and that and the other thing. So that, and all my friends in college were music geeks, and you know, I was never really a record collector because my older brother Mark was the one in the family that brought home all of the Beatles records and everything else. And then I met all these other people that were, and so I was turned on to, you know, Phil Glass and Terry Riley and Steve Reich and all this Eastern kind of sounding music, which really resonated with me, particularly with Steve Reich. I loved his timbres so much. I loved his tape works, you know, Come Out to Show Them and It's Gonna Rain and this and that. And then particularly when he did music for 18 musicians, he translated that delay and feedback into his wonderful percussive orchestrations. And I just adore that piece. That was a big influence too.
You've been in recent years, going back again to your archives, things like Lamentations and the aforementioned Music for Abandoned Airports, for example. And obviously going back to archives is how Disintegration Loop started in the first place. What takes you back there? What are you looking for each time you return?
These are my patches, if you will. You know, I never had those big old Moog synthesizers and all the digital synths that people had. So I had to create my own, and I created a lot in those early days. And so this is my stuff. And we recorded everything. I recorded everything. So there's lots of really crap too. You know, it's not all brilliant, but you never know what, you know, sometimes in fragrances, people will use kind of a little bit of shite in there just to spice it up a little bit. So you never know what can happen.
Anyway, if you're going to do something different with it, it doesn't really matter what the source material is, does it? I mean, it could be almost anything. You can take it in any direction.
Exactly. There's that. But there's also finding forgotten discoveries, which are just like, oh, wow, there's another one. There's another good one. So, yeah.
But it sounds, I mean, people a long time ago used to talk about process music, and it sounds as though the process is very important, probably the most important thing for you.
Well, it's a lifelong process, so.
How do you feel about people sleeping through your work, which is what's going to happen?
It's fine with
Melbourne.
Me, as long as they're not, you know, snoring. But no, they do sometimes. No, I don't care. Do what you want, you know, because, you know, for example, last night I was sleeping with Water Music 2 playing on all night. And it's amazing. That piece ended up becoming such a popular work of mine. And it's great for sleeping. So, you know, had a nice sleep on the new moon in Cancer and woke up feeling good today for a change. Been touring a lot. We've been exhausted.
Well, thanks for making time to talk to me. It's good to catch up with you again. We should do this every 8 years, I think.
Oh, please.
William Basinski's Disintegration Loops. And Basinski is performing the full set of the loops at the Now or Never Festival on Saturday, August the 22nd. Tickets are sold out, but keep an eye on the waiting list if you're interested. Tomorrow, friend of the show, James Gavin, is back. He has written a wonderful biography of the jazz singer Anita O'Day.